From the World Newsroom in Boston, I'm Patrick Cox, and this is The World in Words, number 4. Do you know anyone who speaks any of these languages?
Hakas, Tofa, Tulim, Ho.
Me neither. Today we'll spend some time with people trying to document obscure tongues.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Si se puede, is right. Yes, we can.
There are known knowns. There are things we know that we know.
Thanks, Borat. Why, your own version of Kazakh is somewhat endangered, right? Only spoken by you. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. You can find out more about the show, including how to subscribe to all our podcasts, by going to theworld.org. So, on to endangered languages. You know, I've resisted this subject so far because, let's face it, saving indigenous languages is such a public radio cliche. I know that if you listen to public radio at all, you've heard this story. Pirko Soliki just turned 98. He's the last known speaker of Kwamiki. When he dies, the language will die with him. You've heard that story, right? Don't tell me you haven't. It's a foundation on which public radio was built. So you understand my reluctance. That said, this is a podcast about language and languages. And languages do appear to be dying off faster than ever. And that is worth investigating. So onward, and we'll try to avoid the cliches. First off, an attempt, a Sisyphean attempt, to revive an extinct language. The person trying to do this is a 16-year-old Chilean. The language is called Selknam. Here's Jen Ross in Santiago.
Gilbertian Ten stands on a stage, wearing nothing but a fur loincloth and some paint markings on his face and chest. A small group of people at Chile's Museum of Fine Arts watches and listens as Yanten chants tribal songs. Yanten's interests are a little unusual for a teenager. He spends most of his spare time singing and studying the language of the Selknam people. The now extinct Aboriginal group lived in the Tierra del Fuego islands of southern Chile and Argentina. They were among the last natives in South America to encounter Westerners. Today, Yanten is the only living speaker of a language that died with the last ethnic Selknam in the 1970s. Yanten began studying the language at the age of 8, while doing a school project on Chile's native groups. He says, they started teaching us about indigenous people at school, and I guess I just continued along my own path with the topic. It frustrated me that no one really saw the magnitude of the extinction of an entire race in the South, where you used to see native women with babies in their arms. And now, if you go, you'll only find one or four indigenous faces. That's really sad.
De lo que se va a hablar va ante la oración, ante la frase.
Yanten takes out a Selknam dictionary. He tells me the grammar is different from Spanish because the object comes at the beginning of a sentence. Dictionaries like this one were written by Jesuit missionaries in the early 20th century. They also made recordings of interviews and the songs of medicine women, or shamans. Those recordings helped Yanten learn intonation, but he says he doesn't recreate this woman's chants in his music.
Lo podría hacer, podría grabar también, pero fue un tema de, no sé.
He says, I could copy her, but that would be wrong. The singer was a shaman, and those were her songs. The spirits illuminated her to sing them. I have to be inspired by other spirits. There is something decidedly eerie about the way Yanten sings. Sitting on the patio of his family's modest home in Santiago, he seems to enter a sort of trance. His mother, Yvonne Gomez, says she thinks there's a mystical element to it.
Yo siempre he pensado de que son creencias mías que los espíritus están con él.
She says, I've always believed that the spirits of his ancestors are with him. He goes through many changes of voice and mental state. In fact, Gomez's great-grandfather was Selknam, but she says she didn't tell her son about that until recently. She says, I never wanted to say anything because when I was in school, kids used to tease me and call me an Indian. That made me sad, so I said, why should I tell that to my son? But by the time Dubert was 12, his interest in native languages had practically become an obsession, so his mother told him about his ancestry. She started recording his songs and encouraging him to perform. He's recorded 2 CDs of Selknam music, with money from his own savings and a loan his mother took out. He's also working on writing a new Selknam dictionary. Besides Selknam and Spanish, Yenten also speaks fluent Mapudungun, the language of Chile's largest native group, the Mapuche. And he's learning Yagan, another nearly extinct language. But he considers himself only semi-versed in English.
I am the only person in the world that speak Selknam language.
And that's impressed linguists, like Arturo Hernández with the Catholic University of Temuco.
Lo sorprendente aquí es que no estamos frente a un profesional, sino que estamos hablando frente a un joven.
He says, this boy, out of some personal interest, has rescued a language that was on the verge of being lost forever, and he's initiated this crusade to learn dying languages and make their extinction an issue. In an attempt to reach a wider audience, Yanten's looking to popularize traditional native music by fusing it with modern electronic beats. He admits it's difficult getting people interested in indigenous languages, but he continues trying to learn new languages and improve his fluency in the ones he already knows. And he's trying to pass them on. He's been speaking Selknam to his mother, and she's beginning to pick it up. For the world, this is Jen Ross in Santiago, Chile.
I once got into trouble for using the word oddball in a story I reported, as if that were a put-down. But I have to say, that Chilean kid is an oddball. He is a brilliant, obsessed oddball. And that's not a put-down, that's a compliment. Okay, on to a couple more obsessed people. Their names are David Harrison and Greg Anderson. Between the two of them, they speak about 25 languages. Most of them I've never heard of, just like those ones that we played at the top of the cast.
Hakas, Tofa, Tulim, Ho.
Okay, so these two guys make it their business to record and study dying languages. And wherever they can, they try to help keep them alive. Now, there's a documentary film about this. It's called The Linguists. It was one of the hits of this year's Sundance Film Festival. If you want to find out where the movie is playing, go to thelinguists.com. They're hoping the film will also be shown on PBS. So in the film, you see these linguists traveling to all kinds of remote regions in Bolivia and Siberia and India. And here they are in conversation with the world's Marco Werman. First up is David Harrison.
We encounter amazing people when we go out into the field, last speakers of languages. They have incredible knowledge, and they tell us incredible things, mythology, history, medicinal secrets, just amazing stuff, as well as everyday stuff. But we record all of this, and we try to give as much of it as we can back to the community. We give them copies back. We might make books for them. We might build a talking dictionary on the internet. Many times the recordings that we make of last speakers are the first recordings ever made of these languages, and oftentimes they may very well be the last recordings ever made of these languages.
And quite often it seems like you encounter some surprises, like when you went to Siberia, you were chasing the ancestral language of Chulim. And you went there not knowing if anyone was left to speak it. And even when you find people there, it's kind of a challenge to get them to speak. Let's hear a clip from that trip to Siberia.
Our first real speaker turned out to be very hard of hearing. It's hard with a dying or endangered language because most of the speakers are elderly. Our second speaker alternated between shouting at us and saying that she loved us. I wouldn't call it a conversation.
Yeah, it was a monologue that we had to listen to.
She says, you must be a Kazakh
and I'm Tatar.
I have to say, first of all, there was a real Borat vibe in that village.
Absolutely. I mean, there are these hilarious scenes, Marco, where Greg and I are shouting into the ear of deaf elderly people. maybe a bit senile, maybe missing some teeth, you know, and just trying to get them to remember words from a language that they might not have used on a regular basis in decades.
And in all seriousness now, I mean, then after speaking with these elderly men and women, some of whom are almost completely deaf, there's this revelation that your driver, your guide, actually does speak Chulam. Tell us what happened, because at the beginning, he didn't really cop to knowing anything.
Well, it's not too surprising. People have to sort of suss you out for a while anyway to see if they trust you or what you're after, or really, you know. So it's not too surprising that people kind of keep information to themselves. In the specific case of the former Soviet Union, there were times in which promoting or using the language through even just singing a song in it was essentially the crime of promoting nationalism. And, you know, you could be literally exiled for 20 years hard labor for that. There were incentives to not use the language that were quite strong.
Right, and not unique to Siberia. So languages have been oppressed all over the world, especially in colonial places like Canada, the United States, Australia, South America. And where colonialism left off, globalization has taken over.
Well, I mean, one of the good examples of that is where you travel to India. You go to a boarding school where children from many different ethnic groups are getting what seems to be a good education and learning kind of vocational skills as well, like sewing and learning English. So that would seem to support your notion that people are abandoning native languages because they'll have more economic advantage if they learn a mainstream language. Is that boarding school part of that?
It's part of it, but the irony is there's no reason that anybody has to give up one language in order to speak another one. Any human brain is fully capable of being bilingual or trilingual or quadrilingual. It's simply not true that you have to abandon one language in order to know another one. It's a more subtle cultural pressure that is being put on these children that they should not speak their ancestral language, that they should become culturally assimilated.
And who's applying that pressure? Who's telling them that they should adopt a mainstream language and drop their ancestral language?
Marco, have you ever seen a Bollywood movie?
Yeah.
You know, they typically feature a mix of Hindi and English. They feature the language of the high caste, of the higher educated levels of society. Smaller languages don't typically get promoted in media in such a way that they would have a positive image in the eyes of children.
Now, when you went to India, you go to a really remote part of the country to conduct your research into this language of Sora. You have a process in your research you call elicitation, where you actually point to body parts and colors to get the native speaker to say the words in his or her own language. And then you get to numbers. Let's hear a clip of that part.
Miguel, Miguel, Miguel.
When he said 13,
Miguel boy,
he repeated Miguel the word we had just heard for 12,
Miguel Yagi,
and added Miguel the word 1 to it.
Wow.
The base 12 system?
Yes.
This is not usual. English uses 10 as a base.
But then we got to 30, and he said 2010. So that's a different base.
Our favorite number in Sora, Unjukuri Miguel Boy, is 93.
It's a magnificent system. Yeah, it keeps recycling it, the 12.
Yeah.
It was 4-20-12-1.
20-12-1. That's how you say 93 in Sora.
4 times 20 plus 12 plus 1. What was that like when you heard that?
Well, two things. One is the world doesn't necessarily have to be the way that our language conceptualizes it, and this just reinforces that. And secondly, the beauty of the information packaging. Here's a language where in order to count, you have to automatically be able to do addition and multiplication just to count.
Right, and anecdotally, the math teacher at the boarding school we talked to, you know, quite confidently said that the tribal children, as he put it, learn math much more quickly. That was basically what he said.
Let me ask you this final question. I mean, given all the pressures that you've seen from, you know, cultural pressures like TV and movies and English going into places where nobody speaks that language, post-colonial pressures, economic pressures that you've mentioned, isn't it inevitable that languages will die out?
No, of course it's not inevitable. And we shouldn't be complacent about languages dying out. These are amazing systems of knowledge. We would be outraged, Marco, if the pyramids of Egypt or the Notre Dame Cathedral were going to be demolished tomorrow for no good reason. And when you talk about a language, you're talking about something that's much more ancient. It's the product of human intellect. It's greater than anything that we've built with our hands.
As David was mentioning, species extinction has happened over time. So too have languages died throughout time. But what we're watching now is a mass extinction.
Right. So we want to shake people up a little bit. It is not inevitable, and it does not have to happen.
David Harrison is an assistant professor of linguistics at Swarthmore College, and Greg Anderson, his partner in the film The Linguist, founded the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Thanks a lot, Marco. Had a good time.
By the way, the language you're hearing right now in this piece of music is not, as far as I know, endangered. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's Punjabi. So write to me, tell me I'm wrong. I often am. The address is language@pri.org. Now, there's one thing I wish they'd talked about in that previous interview, and that is it always a good thing to preserve a language, especially if only very few people speak it, and those people are dirt poor with very few opportunities? I mean, would you want to raise a child in a language that might hold him or her back, a language that isn't even spoken in the next town? Now, I'm sure that there are legitimate answers to these questions. I'd like to hear them, so maybe that's something for a future podcast. If you heard last week's podcast, that's podcast number 3, you'll know about creoles. These are languages that often emerged out of slave trades, where people were transported from one part of the world to another. Of course, they had to communicate once they got to their destination. So over time, people started speaking a hybrid, mixing indigenous African languages with indigenous New World languages, and also often with the language of the colonizer. Here in the United States, in parts of South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, there are people trying to revive one of these Creole languages. This language is sometimes known as Gullah, sometimes it's called Geechee, and sometimes Sea Island Creole. Here's the BBC's Matthew Wells.
A group of young South African singers, all dressed in yellow tracksuits, raised their voices at a spot where thousands of their ancestors landed in America as slaves. They've been brought to the seashore here at Lazaretta Creek, close to the historic city of Savannah, by a young African-American who's also a leading member of the self-styled Gullah Geechee Nation. Back on the tour bus, Jamal Touré tells the choir that until recently, English-speaking America, black and white, used to mock the Gullah language, which incorporates African words from many tribes.
They said that we were backwards and primitive, but guess what they didn't discover? That we Gullah Geechees, those of us in Georgia and in South Carolina and northern Florida, we are the living links, because we the yam. And see, we know that if someone is from West Africa, they say here yam, that means to eat. Because that one, I walk in there this morning and so I got yam, and I said, look at the people, they yam for the food.
Several million African Americans can claim to be Gullah, but far fewer speak the multifaceted language or observe the family and rural-based traditions that go with it. Rituals stretching back to Africa have been kept alive on the coastal islands here and beyond, but Jamal says that the internet era has helped to revive his fractured culture.
We are a land people and also a water people. And that one of the things that I say that weaves it all together and connects all of us is the fact of the language. You got Gullah Geechee, such as myself, who went online back in the 1990s, and I'm like happy because I'm like, now I'm not just this little bird out there by myself.
So I'm in the car now with Jamal. We just left Savannah. We're heading down a sunlit highway past trees laden with Spanish moss. And where are we going to now, Jamal?
We're now headed to Geechee Kunda, the Gullah Geechee Cultural Center and Museum for the state of Georgia, for southern South Carolina and northern Florida. Kunda is a Saracole word, which means compound.
How are you?
How you doing?
Very good, thanks.
Welcome
thanks
to
for.
Geechee Kunda.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me over.
Yeah. I'm Jim Bacote. This is my mama, Sally Gill.
Hi, how are you, Mom?
The language is the shallowest aspect of it, because as you move around, as you are not necessarily permanently assimilated, but after you go away, if you're around people that talk another way for 40 years like I've been, it leaves. But then when you come back and you get among the Geechee talkers, like right here in Riceboro, you got more right here in Riceboro than any place in America. It's a close sense of family, a spiritual bond to draw you back. We know that this is our holy land.
You say you come back again. I take me a second. I'll cook you right up inside your head.
Well, if I hit until you never come back home.
Gullah blends together pre-20th century English and African languages with a heavy patois that varies from house to house.
That have a legal sense to it. I understand. I got you. But then I always like to let them know, say, I the father.
A big part of the Gullah Geechee culture is just to sit around and tell stories. We've had music and we've had prayers and we've had dancing, and now people are just sitting under the tree here. There are three or four generations of people here just listening to stories.
Come by here, my Lord, come by here. Come by here, my Lord, come by here. Come by here.
Many descendants of the Gullah tradition have lost touch with it completely, and rampant redevelopment along the coast has dismantled many of the older settlements. The elders of the nation have convinced Congress to fund a new commission, which will try to repair the damage and save one of America's oldest cultures. Griffin Lotson is a leading Gullah Geechee politician.
We were taught to lose that Geechee. Don't, you're too Geechee boy. Now that it's a cultural thing, we embrace it. We're going to lose land. We are going to, culture will die if we don't do something right now. It's just that it's so critical that Congress has voted that it's one of the most endangered cultures in America. I use my little political savvy and knowledge of how the political process works to keep it at the forefront. I plan to continue to do it. If we can get Jim and some of the others on this board, they're going to do the same thing also, to push it as hard as we can.
Jesus, all our sins and grief to bear.
Okay, that's it for this edition of The World in Words. I'm Patrick Cox. Check out our beautiful new website at theworld.org. Hats off to Catherine Murphy. Next week, we take a trip to Arizona, where there's an almighty backlash against Spanish. So, hasta la próxima vez. Ooh, that was terrible pronunciation.